My name is Paul Olson, and this is a session on Martin Luther King's essay, Letter from the Birmingham Jail. And the gist of it will be Martin Luther King as an extremist for love. Before we begin, I'd like to just say a couple things about a white person teaching black literature. And to suggest to some of you who may be new to black literature, and if you are new to black literature, I think I have some ideas and some possibilities to begin. Most of us, black and white, are victims of a racist educational system which has really kept the black man and the black woman out of anthologies. For instance, I just looked through our library here and found lots of collections of short stories, and I was trying to find one in particular, and in looking for that one, I found that in about 9 different anthologies, there was never any black writer represented. Now, a lot of those books are brought in from other college libraries and so on that people give, and that's typical. And that's why I'm beginning with these ideas that I have down here in green and blue. If you've never read anything by a black author, here are some books that are not bad starts. And by not bad starts, I mean they acquaint you with some of the breadth and the scope of race relations in America. And they are also very, very fine literature. Our bookstore here has Song of Solomon. And I've taught that in a college classroom for several years, and it is always, in the contemporary American black literature course, the book that students pick as the best. Toni Morrison's Song of Solomon. It's in our library. And I get a 10% commission on every one it's sold, so if you go over there. Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes Were Watching God. Really quite recently getting all the great critical acclaim as one of the fine pieces of literature in among American literature. And then, of course, in our bookstore also has The Color Purple. More publicly acclaimed because of the movie. If you saw the movie and read the book, both, I think everyone that's done that will all say that the book is even better. And a caution about this, if you're new to American black literature, you might have to read this book this way. Read the first 30 pages and then start over. Because by then you'll know what's going on and you get a sense of the format, but let me tell you that it's worth it. It's worth the work of getting this sense of letters that she writes, and then coming back and having them understand it. These three are available in our bookstore just across the street. Some other really classical literature, I think, that comes out of the American black experience that, in my opinion, as a student of literature, rank up there with anything Faulkner does, with anything Hemingway does, and in some cases, I mean, I think most people would say our greatest American writer, it's hard to say that, but it might be Mark Twain. We're getting close here to real American classic stuff. And so I'm encouraging you to make this kind of pilgrimage into the black American experience. And if you're new to that, what it'll do for you is give you a whole new outlook on American history and on race relations in America. Is that a question or a stroke with the needle? Okay. Okay. Well, Uncle Tom's Children is by Richard Wright. Black Boy is a fictional autobiographical sketch by Richard Wright. Both are very powerful. Now, I'm not going to push these anymore. I just want to mention them. Not Without Laughter is by Langston Hughes. It's a wonderful story for anybody, but maybe especially for youngsters. I don't mean 9-year-olds, 10-year-olds, but 15, 16, 17. This is a story of a young boy growing up in racist America. And it's a wonderful story, and it's, I'll come back to it. It ends very uplifting in spite of the racial oppression that's there. Song of Solomon, I've mentioned, I've mentioned The Color Purple, I've mentioned. The Autobiography of Frederick Douglass is a slave narrative. And I know that everyone, as I just looked through here, I'm guessing that you were brought up on the same kind of education that I was, and you didn't really know what slavery was all about, because slavery was told to us by white people. And as one black slave writer said, It is not he who is looked on who tells the truth, but he who has endured. So you have to read slave narratives to understand that part of American history and to understand that growth in American literature too. So the autobiography of Frederick Douglass is powerful and fast reading, and that's why I've selected these few, if you want to write some things down, as ways to begin your trek through American black literature, because they are especially powerful, especially readable, because they're the greatest. I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings by Maya Angelou, that's contemporary. The Street by Ann Petrie is, if you want to learn about city life in the black experience, The Street is a fine one. Man-Child in a Promised Land is also that, is I think, city life. And we can go on with lots of them, but I think if you're interested in beginning, you might want to go through some of these, and if you want to talk about any of them later, I'll be happy to do that. Any questions on that part? And we'll get right into Martin Luther King then. King's essay is an important, vital essay in understanding the civil rights movement of the 60s. If that's all that it were, it would be an essay that would last 20 years. It's also an essay that is important and vital for our whole philosophical outlook on life. And that makes it perhaps one of America's top five or six essays ever written by an American writer. I've written some others by English language writers. I've written some others you may have heard of. Dorothy Sayers, Are Women Human? George Orwell, Politics in the English Language. E.B. White's, Once More to the Lake. C.S. Lewis's, What Christians Believe. Martin Luther King's, Letter from the Birmingham Jail. We're talking very good company, and I hope that in this half hour of my talking and then the half hour of your exchange, we'll decide that indeed Martin Luther King's essay is a great, important, vital instrument in the civil rights movement. But again, it's an important, vital instrument in a philosophical outlook of life, thereby giving it a kind of universal quality that for sure it deserves. What I'm going to do, since we don't have that copy, we don't have a copy of the essay in front of us, and maybe many of you have read it, maybe many of you haven't. It doesn't matter. I will highlight these ideas first, and then we'll discuss them. You can stop me anytime you want to, and then there'll be lots of time to discuss these ideas at the end. Yes?
There's a copy that people can read in the Resource Center and in the Goffman Building if you care to.
Thank you. And there are several copies in our library here. This book I have checked out just for today, A Testament of Hope. And that has the letter of Birmingham Jail in it. And there are several others that do too. So you can sure find it here in Holden if you're interested in doing that. The five main ideas that we'll focus, and there are other ideas in this powerfully intense and yet broad-scoped essay, we'll look first at his idea of an outsider coming into a place that's not his town. I mean, why should I care? And, you know, he calls himself an outsider. Why is he there? We'll look at his criteria for just and unjust laws. We'll look at his disappointment in the white moderates and his discussion of white moderates versus white extremists, and he puts that in a biblical context as well as a philosophical context. We'll look at his, in my opinion, it's an insightful, brilliant insightful idea about time's neutrality. And I noticed that my wife, who did a grief recovery session, talked about using time in the process of recovering from grief. Well, it places a certain amount of responsibility on we human beings, on us human beings, and that's what King does too with his time is neutral concept. And finally, the discussion of the means and end and how do we go about achieving justice, and of course he focuses on violence and nonviolence, but he has a more profound, more general and more philosophical idea of do the means justify the ends, and so on. We'll look at those ideas and then discuss while we go. So, if you'll forgive me for just reading, but I have a loud voice and you'll hear it clearly, I'm sure. This is written in 1963, and King is in jail, as you might guess from the title, eh? He's in jail for participating in civil rights action. And an open letter was written by 8 clergymen, white, published in a newspaper, and said, "Dear Dr. King," and in a sense it said, well, you know, okay, you're right, but slow down. And then it's interesting then that this essay has been anthologized and published in a book called Why We Can't Wait. And it's almost a better title, because in a way it's a title for this essay. This is Why We Can't Wait Anymore. Well, he wrote his essay on the edges of the letter to him that he read in the newspaper. That's how he composed the whole thing. And then eventually put it all together, of course, and did some editing, I think. But here we go then, in 1963. My dear fellow clergymen, responding to the 8 white clergymen who wrote to him. While condemned here in the Birmingham City Jail, I came across your recent statement calling our present activities unwise and untimely. Seldom, if ever, do I pause to answer criticism of my work and ideas. If I sought to answer all of the criticisms that cross my desk, my secretaries would be engaged in little else in the course of the day, and I would have no time for constructive work. But since I feel that you are men of genuine goodwill, and your criticisms are sincerely set forth, I would like to answer your statement in what I hope will be patient and reasonable terms. I'm not going to stop with every phrase that he puts out, but just note that he trusts that these men are of genuine goodwill, and that's part of the pain in writing, and it's part of the problem in America, is that there are a lot of white people of goodwill who fall in this category here, the white moderates, who have all the right thoughts, but don't go any further than that. And we'll look at that. But that's how it begins, too. Hey, you guys are good guys. So note that I think that's that attitude and that atmosphere that he creates as he continues. I think I should give the reason for my being in Birmingham, since you have been influenced by the argument of outsiders coming in. I was in college when a lot of this went on, and I remember the college kids from the north, white and black, coming to the south and get out of here. We'll solve our problems. You have no right. It's none of your business. Well, King is responding to that, too. I have the honor of serving as president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, an organization operating in every southern state with headquarters in Atlanta, Georgia. Let's skip some of that. I am here because I have basic organizational ties with this Southern Conference. Beyond this, I am in Birmingham because injustice is here. Just as the 8th century prophets left their little villages and carried their Thus Saith the Lord far beyond the boundaries of their hometowns, and just as the Apostle Paul left his little village of Tarsus and carried the gospel of Jesus Christ to practically every hamlet and city of the Greco-Roman world, I too am compelled to carry the gospel of freedom beyond my particular hometown. Moreover, I am cognizant of the interrelatedness of all communities and states. I cannot sit idly by in Atlanta and not be concerned about what happens in Birmingham. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. Is it Robert Niemöller? Niemöller? Help me out. Theologian from Germany. Martin. Martin, yeah. What's his real famous saying? Do you remember how it goes?
I didn't say anything in the meeting because I...
Yes, the one, yeah.
When they came for the Poles, I didn't say anything because I wasn't Polish. When they came for the Russians, I was...
Keep going, that's good.
I didn't say anything because I wasn't Russian. They came for the Jews, I didn't say anything because I wasn't Jewish. And when they finally came for my people, yeah, there was nobody to stand up for me.
Yeah. Right. If it, and that's a nice... illustration of what King means, that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. I've done this analogy with students. I'll tell you a story. 4 years ago, teaching a particularly intense novel full of violence and full of white hatred for blacks and black hatred for whites, I got into a lengthy discussion after class with another white student who just kept pushing and pushing and pushing. And he finally called me a name, and I reached across between us and I slugged him right in the mouth. How does that make you feel about me? Are you going to engage me in a little dialogue after this class? Well, let me tell you that I never did that, and that's not true. But just for a moment, you had that feeling like, golly. And that was another place and another time. And I use it to illustrate for you what king means. And just how you felt for a moment about me, about injustice anywhere as a threat. So I unjustly slugged somebody. Again, I remind you, I didn't. Never hit anybody, okay? Except my kid's bottom once in a while. But we have that, then you feel, ooh, that was unjust. And if he can do it to him, he can do it to me, and he can do it. I've illustrated for you, I hope, how injustice travels over space and time, and how accurate King is. In any nonviolent campaign, there are four basic steps. Collection of the facts to determine whether injustices are alive. And he has about a page on how he collected the facts, and indeed, we don't need to go over that, the injustices were alive. Right? I mean, there was still Jim Crow, and Jim Crow is that phrase for the legalized and also the mores of the society, separation by color, by race. First, we collect the facts to see if injustices are alive. Second, negotiations. Third, self-purification. And fourth, direct action. Self-purification was a matter of taking all their people who were willing to demonstrate in, and they would actually hit them and say, okay, can you take it? How long can you take it? You can't hit back, ever. And they actually practice that. And that's what he means by purification. It's an incredible thing to understand in this wonderful essay, and I'm sorry I'm so full of adjectives for it. But it suggests to you the lengths that he and they took, the lengths they went to achieve their purpose and to make their struggle for freedom. You may well ask, why direct action? Why sit-ins, marches, etc.? Isn't negotiation a better path? You are exactly right in your call for negotiation. Indeed, this is the purpose of direct action. Nonviolent direct action seeks to create such a crisis and establish such creative tension that a community that has constantly refused to negotiate is forced to confront the issue. My friends, I must say to you that we have not made a single gain in civil rights without determined legal and nonviolent pressure. History is the long and tragic story of the fact that privileged groups seldom give up their privileges voluntarily. Individuals may see the moral light and voluntarily give up their unjust posture. But as Reinhold Niebuhr has reminded us, groups are more immoral than individuals. Do you have any illustrations of that? Can you think of what he might mean by that? I'll run it by this part again. Individuals may see the moral light and voluntarily give up their unjust posture. But as Reinhold Niebuhr has reminded us, groups are more immoral. Pardon me?
Mob action.
Sure, any kind of mob action. Ku Klux Klan, where then it's a great illustration, where they can hide under a white robe and not even be seen. And anytime, it's a wonderful illustration, anytime we see mob action, what do we have?
Anonymity
and individual responsibility is gone. I remember reading the most powerful scene to me in Peter Berger's Precarious Vision, a book about the role of Jesus Christ in society, and yet the illustration I remember best is that in firing squads in World War I, seven men would fire, and one of them had a blank, but no one knew which one had the blank. So that each man in the firing squad could go home thinking, or hoping, I had the blank. You see what it does? Diminishes personal responsibility. And King understands it, as Reinhold Niebuhr did. Groups are more immoral than individuals. I look at American history through the eyes of the American slave, and I see that slavery is related to that concept. I look at the Holocaust in World War II, and we see that that's part of that concept. I look at, on a college campus, fraternity and sorority initiation, and I see that as part of that concept. The groups are more and more, no one would think of walking up to their friend with a paddle that long and swatting them on the hind end until they were black and blue. I coach and I see men in the locker room and I see them. No one would do that individually, but in a group, our individual morality is lost to anonymity and we're not responsible anymore. Then this long, wonderful paragraph where he's most explicit with the kind of poetic images that motivate the reader to understand his abstract ideas. And he talks about what it's like to be victim of prejudice for 340 years. 1619. Anybody know that date? First slave ship in America. I mean, they got here before the pilgrims did. In other words, our white people coming in 1607 were pretty eager. Let's get us some slaves to settle this. So it's okay. We have waited for more than 340 years, and that's why I wanted to mention that date, for our constitutional and God-given rights. The nations of Asia and Africa are moving with jet-like speed toward the goal of political independence, and we still creep at horse and buggy pace toward the gaining of a cup of coffee at a lunch counter. I guess it is easy for those who have never felt the stinging darts of segregation to say, wait. But when you have seen, and watch his imagery, but when you have seen vicious mobs lynch your mothers and fathers at will and drown your sisters and brothers at whim, when you have seen hate-filled policemen curse, kick, brutalize, and even kill your black brothers and sisters with impunity, when you see the vast majority of your 20 million Negro brothers smothering in an airtight cage of poverty in the midst of an affluent society, when you suddenly find your tongue twisted and your speech stammering as you seek to explain to your six-year-old daughter why she can't go to the public amusement park that has just been advertised on television, and see tears welling up in her little eyes when she is told that Fun Town is closed to colored children, and see the depressing clouds of inferiority begin to form in her little mental sky, and see her begin to distort her little personality by unconsciously developing a bitterness toward white people. When you have to concoct an answer for a five-year-old son asking in agonizing pathos, Daddy, why do white people treat colored people so mean? When you take a cross-country drive and find it necessary to sleep night after night in the uncomfortable corners of your automobile because no motel will accept you. When you are humiliated day in and day out by nagging signs reading white and colored. When your first name becomes nigger and your middle name becomes boy, however old you are, and your last name becomes John. And when your wife and mother are never given the respected title Mrs. When you are harried by day and haunted by night by the fact that you are a Negro, living constantly a tiptoe stance, never quite knowing what to expect next, and plagued with inner fears and outer resentments. When you are forever fighting a degenerating sense of nobodiness, then you will understand why we find it difficult to wait. There comes a time when the cup of endurance runs over, and men and women are no longer willing to be plunged into an abyss of injustice where they experience the blackness of corroding despair. I hope, sirs, you can understand our legitimate and unavoidable impatience. Two little anecdotal side stories to this last illustration. One, out of the book, Not Without Laughter. The episode where Sandy, the hero of the story, got some coupons from his teacher, interracial school he goes to, and his white friends and his black friends got these coupons to go to the carnival in town. And Sandy is black, the hero of the story, and his little friend Earl is white. And they run, and they're excited. They've been looking forward for days to get to this carnival. And they get up to the gate, and the white man at the gate takes Earl's tickets and says to Sandy, very nicely, sorry, you can't come in. That's all he said. Sandy understood right away, and he turns to Earl, and they walk away together just for a moment. Earl doesn't understand it. Sandy doesn't understand it. It's their first real experience with the power of the racist society. And Sandy says, here, take my tickets. And Earl says, well, you're not going to go? Nah, I don't want to. I decided I don't want to. And the scene ends there with Earl taking the tickets, going into the park. Now, Earl's innocent, but he's growing up, experiencing and what? Perpetuating the status quo by participating unknowingly in the racism of the society. So in that episode, Earl and Sandy are both victims. I think Martin Luther King understands that. But, one of the reasons he writes this essay is to suggest to all of us we need to reorient our vision to understand how we are all victims of the racism in society. And then Earl, with better vision, we can't expect it of a six-year-old, but we can of adults, with better vision says, if you ain't going, I ain't either. Or something. I don't know what the proper response is. That would probably be on our level, maybe. But something that suggests another kind of vision to establish something that's not going to continue the status quo. And the other illustration along with that, where Martin Luther King says, when you are harried by day and haunted by night by the fact that you are a Negro. We won't do it because I don't want to take that kind of time. But sometime in a group of friends, black or white or mixed doesn't make any difference. Ask them to take this kind of existential test of listing adjectives or nouns that describe who they are. For instance, I'll do that for myself. I am a teacher, a father, a coach, a son, a hiker. List all those things. And then, as you discuss that, perhaps, note that it's very unusual for a white person to say, I am white. It's very unusual for a black person not to say, I am black. Because this society continually reminds him or her of that role in society, of the role of being black in society. And that's what King means, I think, when he says, you're haunted day and day night, harried by day and haunted by night. Because you walk up to a motel and you have the point. Well, then he has a discussion of just and unjust laws. And I'm not going to read, but I'll summarize. But he suggests that we have an obligation to break unjust laws. And then the first question that comes to mind, I suspect, is if you have an obligation to break unjust laws, who's going to decide which are just and which are unjust, and how do you prevent anarchy? And then he gives us some criteria for that. And his criteria, I think, is really insightful. Take a simple example first. We know, we've all agreed in this room, that we will stop at red lights at every intersection. But if your best friend is bleeding to death in the car seat beside you, you're going to go through the red light. And you're not going to think about it being immoral at all, are you? I mean, I've got to get this guy, this gal, to the hospital. And you break the law because you know that morally that's what you have to do. You go through the red light. Well, there are laws that are more important than that. But we can't do that anytime we want to. Geez, I'm going to be late for the show. I'm going to go through the red light. Somebody's going to get hurt. Criteria number one for a law to be just, it must be rooted in eternal and natural law. Think for a moment of King's time and the segregation in the South. And really before, well, the separate water fountains, right? The separate lunch counters, the separate toilet facilities, and so on. When you're tired, what do? Everybody, biologically. You sleep, you sit down, you rest. If you're black and you want to sit down on the bus in Birmingham, Alabama, what do? And a white person comes on the bus. You stand up. It violates just natural law. When you're thirsty, what do? We drink. And there's a fountain that says white only. It violates natural law. So when he goes on, he doesn't give these kind of illustrations. He just suggests that a just law is one that is rooted in eternal and natural law. It's rooted in God's law. I think we have to understand that in the sense that king means it, because I remember about 3 years ago when four people bombed an abortion clinic in Florida because they thought it was God's law. You know, God spoke to me, they said. Remember that? And so, I'm going to bomb this clinic. Well, a lot of people speak about God's law, and they're crazy. So King doesn't let us interpret it that way. He suggests eternal, natural law. Second one, it uplifts human personality. Sorry, kid. You can't come in. What a wonderful criteria. If every law we had uplifted the human personality. Think of the struggle for women's rights in America. Think of the struggle for civil rights and all kinds of human rights throughout the world. The unhampered right to vote. He suggests, does the minority have a role in creating the laws that have affected the minority? And of course the answer is no. In the case of South Africa, it's the majority that doesn't have a right to vote. But to be a just law, it has to have an unhampered right to vote for everybody to make his decision about this. And finally, the minority and the majority will follow the law. Not that the majority will create a law that only the minority has to follow. The majority says, I submit that an individual who breaks a law that conscience tells him is unjust and willingly accepts the penalty by staying in jail to arouse the conscience of the community over its injustice.
I have almost reached the regrettable conclusion that the Negro's great stumbling block in the stride toward freedom is not the white citizen's counselor or the Ku Klux Klanner, but the white moderate who is more devoted to order than to justice, who prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice, who constantly says, I agree with you in the goal you seek, but I can't agree with your methods of direct action, who paternalistically feels that he can set the timetable for another man's freedom. In early American history, there's a debate between John Brown, the great white abolitionist, and some other white men. And John Brown says, slavery is evil, kill it. The response is, we'll form a committee. Slavery is evil, kill it. We'll study the issue. Slavery is evil, kill it. And they keep coming back with some kind of rebuttal that escapes looking at the issue and finally taking action. And John Brown's response throughout is, slavery is evil, kill it. It's an absolute, based on some of the things that King has suggested here too. And that's the difference between the white moderate and the white extremist. We might use liberal and radical. More illustrations on extremism. Was not Jesus an extremist in love? Love your enemies, bless them that curse you, pray for them that despitefully use you? Was not Amos an extremist for justice? He quotes him, let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. Was not Paul an extremist for the gospel of Jesus Christ? And he quotes him, I bear in my body the marks of the Lord. Was not Martin Luther an extremist? Here I stand, I can do none other, so help me God. And he goes on with some other examples of extremists who stood up for something with their actions beyond their words. All Christians know that the colored people will receive equal rights eventually, but it is possible that you are in too great of a religious hurry. It has taken Christianity almost 2,000 years to accomplish what it has, and what it's accomplished is up for grabs, I think, in lots of people's minds. The teaching, and this is different though, the teachings of Christ take time to come to earth. That's the moderate who agrees, and who agrees with the idea, but not the, he doesn't want to do any action. And that's the point there, the white moderate, the white extremist. After he discusses the idea of the white moderate wanting to take time, he gives this pretty interesting observation. "Actually," says King, "time is neutral. It can be used either destructively or constructively. I am coming to feel that the people of ill will have used time much more effectively than the people of goodwill." I use that over and over when I counsel college students who, every year it happens, some guy comes to Augustana and breaks up with his girlfriend, and he can't study, and he can't run, and he can't, you know, his life is shattered. And I ask him, "Well, what do? Do you go home and reread her letters?" "Oh, yeah." "You got a picture on your desk?" "Oh, yeah." "Okay. Why don't you go home and send her picture back, burn her letters, and go out with your lab partner?" "Oh, I never thought of that." And the idea is using time constructively or destructively for the person's just well-being as a freshman in college. Then they start dating their lab partner, and Augustana suddenly becomes a good place. Okay, that's where I teach. And the last one before it's all your turn. "I must close now. But before closing, I am impelled to mention one other point in your statement that troubled me profoundly. You warmly commended the Birmingham police force for keeping order and preventing violence. I don't believe you would have so warmly commended the police force if you had seen its angry, violent dogs literally biting 6 unarmed, nonviolent Negroes. I don't believe you would so quickly commend the policemen if you had observed their ugly and inhuman treatment of Negroes here in the city jail, if you had watched them push and curse old Negro women and young Negro girls, if you would see them slap and kick old Negro men and young boys, if you will observe them as they did on 2 occasions, refuse to give us food because we wanted to sing our grace together. I am sorry that I can't join you in your praise for the police department. It is true that they have been rather disciplined in their public handling of the demonstrators. In this sense, they have been rather publicly nonviolent. But for what purpose? To preserve the evil system of segregation. Over the last few years, I have consistently preached that nonviolence demands that the means we use must be as pure as the ends we seek." So here's where Malcolm X and Martin Luther King are at odds. But King wonders, how long can you keep away from the violence? "But now I must affirm that it is just as wrong, or even more so, to use moral means, that is peacekeeping, to preserve immoral ends." Maybe, and he names some names of the police chief and so on. "Maybe Mr. Connor and his policemen have been rather publicly nonviolent, as Chief Pritchett was in Albany, Georgia. But they have used the moral means of nonviolence to maintain the immoral end of flagrant racial injustice. T.S. Eliot has said that there is no greater treason than to do the right deed for the wrong reason."